Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Jack Cornish is a programme manager for the Don't Lose Your Way campaign at Ramblers, the UK charity promoting walking and defending rights of way. That's the day job, but there's much more walking in Jack than just from 9 to 5. He's walked the entire length of the British Isles and is walking every street in London. The interview opens with me asking Jack what Don't Lose Your Way is all about and what his role entails. Let's start with, what does a programme manager do at the Ramblers?
But Don't Lose Your Way, which is the programme I manage, it's a little bit of everything, really. It's developing IT stuff, it's supporting volunteers, it's talking to the media, it's talking with colleagues to government. So a bit of everything, really. Jack of all trades.
Do it your own way, no? Don't Lose Your Way?
So Don't Lose Your Way is the project of the Ramblers, which is about finding and claiming historic rights of way, putting them back on the map so they can be used and enjoyed before they're lost forever in 2026.
Okay, so quick explanation. When you say get back on the map, but there is a map, isn't there?
Every local authority has to have a legal record of all the rights of way in their area, except for Inner London and except for Scotland and the Isles of Scilly, weirdly enough. But every local authority has to have a legal record. It's called the definitive map, and that shows where all of the rights of way are. So footpaths, bridleways, restricted byways in their area. And if it's something's not recorded on there, then it isn't recorded as a public right of way. So loads of them that just weren't added to the map.
Well, hang on, how can that be? I mean, surely every alleyway and path is walked, and if it's not, it might be on private land and someone might not be all that keen on ramblers wandering across
it. Well, if you think about it, nearly all public rights of way are across private land, and that's sort of, in some countries, could be quite a revolutionary idea. You know, the idea of public rights of way goes back centuries in this country, but back in the late 40s that the Act came in, actually local authorities had to actually record them, and so the public could actually know their rights. That was part of the Attlee government, and it, you know, for me it sort of sits alongside the NHS or nationalisation industries as a radical move, because this is, you know, public rights being asserted and being protected. So those maps were drawn up back then, but things were left off, things were missed. Some of those rights of way could be things that weren't actually used at the time, but were rights of way in the past, and therefore they should remain rights of way. So it could be an old lane or an old footpath that goes back centuries and centuries. It wasn't in use in the 50s, so they didn't put it on the map. You get some instances where not many rights of way were added because you look back and all of the parish council at the time were all the local, was the big landowner in the area, and so magically not many rights of way were added. Or sometimes it's just mistakes, you know, things, they just forgot to draw a path on the map they were drawing up, and so now that isn't actually recorded and protected and potentially isn't even used now, but it could be in the future.
And I assume there are quite a few areas which might be sort of military exercise areas as well that could have been overlooked or weren't included.
It's funny you say that, because one of the things that comes up quite a lot is rights of way that were stopped up in an emergency in the Second World War. So they might be roads, they might be footpaths or whatever, and they weren't reinstated properly after the Second World War. So, you know, in the east of England, for instance, where it's nice and flat, you get a lot of air bases that were thrown up quickly. Yeah, they didn't reinstate the rights of way afterwards, and so we want to try and claim them and get them walked again.
How are you going about it? That's a lot of territory.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, we've got some amazingly dedicated volunteers in the Ramblers and, you know, outside as well. What we want to do is we want to create this as a sort of mass citizen movement. You know, this is about reclaiming our history, reclaiming our rights. What we've created at the moment is a really simple, like, website you can go on, and you basically, you get a square kilometre of the map anywhere in England and Wales you want. You get a square of the old map, so that's an OS map from about 120 years ago, and another map called the Bartholomew map, which is sort of quite a nice road map. And you compare that to the current OS map, and you spot the difference. Draw on if you can see a footpath on the old one and new one.
Is it just down to spotting trackways or pathways on a map? I'm surely there can be quite a lot of things being misconstrued.
Yeah, I mean, so what we're doing at this stage is we want to do this big task of identifying all the potential lost rights of way. But for every single one of those paths, that's only the beginning. Basically, what we then want people to do, and again, we want the public, this is not just a Ramblers thing, we want everyone to get involved, is to actually research that individual route, look for different pieces of evidence from across history, a lot of them from the late 18th, 19th, early 20th century, for evidence that this was actually a public route so at some point in the past.
So you're appealing to local historians as much as you are to Ramblers and...
Exactly, yeah, yeah. There is something really satisfying about delving into the history of a particular route, because it shows how an area has evolved over time. It shows, you know, these paths were originally put down by people going where they walked to the market town or where they went to the pub or to the field. And so
went to work in the fields.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. You know, and a lot of them weren't laid down. They were created through usage. And so delving into that history, you know, it's fascinating in of itself, but at the same time, it actually is a tangible result at the end of it, and you could actually put a path back on the map that could be there for hundreds of years into the future. It's sort of potentially, you know, quite a nice legacy for somebody.
You mentioned a website in which you're gathering the information, or people can look up where they can get the maps. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more about how people can start and help you find those lost ways.
You go to ramblers.org.uk/don't-lose-your-way. Basically, you sign up there and you know, we've got 150,000 squares to do, and you'll be able to get cracking with doing one square at a time from there, really. The way we've done it is that you can literally just click on a square and select that, and you can either search for somewhere and, you know, go to where you grew up or where you live, see what it used to look like and see what's missing, but also you can just go, I want a random square of the country, and that's quite fun as well.
Let me get this right. When they pick their square and they've identified something,
yeah,
is it for them to approach their local authority to get it on the definitive map, or is that something that Ramblers will do?
You know, we want people to be identifying them, and by doing a square, we're not, there's no commitment to following that through. The next stage is, you know, we want some of those people, and hopefully a lot of those people, to then sort of adopt one of those paths that's been mapped. It might be in the square they did, it might be any of the squares, and pull together research so they can claim it to the local authority. And, you know, ultimately, it's members of the public that will be claiming these routes, but the Ramblers are here to support that and to, you know, get as many useful routes across the lines so we can save them.
Okay, so I know you caused a bit of a Twitter storm by asking people to tell you what the local name
yes.
for a path is.
Yeah.
So would you like to give a couple of examples of unusual names that paths have been given?
They sort of break down into quite a few different sort of categories. Like, you've got those great names for, like, alleyways in towns and cities, like Twittons and Ginnells. And there's a guy up in Cumbria who focuses on loonings, which are sort of lanes in Cumbria, in the Cumbrian dialect. And there's some amazing one. I think there's, like, wine looning, which was this sort of lane that was used by smugglers to bring up wine from the coast. Paths sort of tell us something about our history and show how people have evolved over time, I think, and how the landscape has evolved, say.
Okay, so are there certain counties or certain areas where there's a paucity of paths, and you reckon there are old ways there and they need to be identified? And is there an area where you say, well, we've actually found 100 new paths or 100 old paths and reinstated them? So is there a sort of a success story, and is there a big hole you want people to aim for?
In some ways, there'll be holes everywhere. And one thing you do find is you find an area that's got loads of rights of way, but then you've got one parish that just doesn't have hardly any. So you get these sort of local gaps. But for instance, down in Cornwall, some of our volunteers there have estimated there are in the thousands of routes that aren't recorded. Probably quite a few of those are used all the time, and they're these sort of lanes that go between houses and that connect up the more sort of busy roads. Now, they're probably not under direct threat of being developed, although they could be, but if you don't live in the area and you look at an OS map, for instance, you have no idea if that's a private driveway to someone's house. You have no idea if you can walk down there. So
I'm going to say it to be a driveway to a sports ground in London.
Exactly. I mean, in terms of success stories, I mean, we've had applications going all across the country, but a couple that I was looking at the other day were in a parish in Suffolk, and it's by one of our long-standing volunteers who I think put these applications in early 2000s or in the 90s, and they're now back on the map. But one of the paths is part of the Icknield Way. So this was a section that just wasn't recorded as a right-of-way. And obviously, you know, arguably it's a right-of-way going back to prehistory, you know, before the concept of rights-of-way existed. And he put in one go, with one application, he put 8 miles of this route on
Fantastic.
The map. So that was in a parish where there was hardly any rights-of-way. And just sort of along from it, there was another one. You know, I think it was called Six Tree Way, and it's another old lane and connects up a sort of island of, if you come across islands of open access land, mm-hmm. So because open access land is recorded by ecology, basically they're quite sort of random sometimes, and so there was this island of open access land that you couldn't actually access, you know, I think unless you had a parachute you couldn't actually get into it. I don't know how you get out afterwards, you know, just adding that route not only, you know, had that linear route but opened up, you know, more places to walk sort of in total, I suppose.
You yourself, you've walked many of lanes yourself. I know you walked from Land's End to John O'Groats. Or did you go from John O'Groats to Land's End?
I went Land's End to John O'Groats. I went with the seasons up the country. That was the theory behind that, anyway.
And how long did that take you?
Well, I don't know if this is foolish or not, but I decided not to go a quick route. I sort of worked out how long I could afford to be away for, and then did about 6 months of research about different places in the country I wanted to visit, and then tried to link up as many as possible. So I did about 1,500 miles in about 4 months, something like that. So, yeah, no, it was amazing to sort of
Well, that's pretty see incredible. The country. I basically, you did 6 months research while you were at work doing something,
yeah.
And then 4 months actually walking. Wow. I mean, that's a huge task. And did you stay at hostels or stay with friends, or did you do some camping or a bit of both? Or
a mixture of all of the above, really. I didn't even have a tent. I had a sort of hybrid bivvy, but it goes down to sort of ridiculously lightweight, made in Derbyshire, I think. Really nice, beautiful tent. Yeah, so a bit of camping, bit of hostels, Airbnb sometimes, staying with friends, yeah. And made my way up the country like that, really.
And did you walk most of the time on your own, or was it you teamed up with other people as you went along?
Yeah, I was pretty much solo most of the time. I got various friends join me for a weekend or a week or whatever, pretty much solo. Yeah, it was amazing just to sort of, it's that different, you sort of switch quite quickly into that different pace of life. And I don't just mean literally the walking, but the sort of, you know, all you need to think about is, where am I going to stay tomorrow night? Have I got enough food for today? And that's sort of it. Oh, and where am I going? And I don't think I lost my way too many times. I mean, like, there were places in the country where it's much harder to walk.
Were you carrying maps, or were you all on a phone?
I was totally digital. Yeah, okay. It was just over 2 years ago. I liked the idea of doing it with paper maps, but I looked into it, and I think it would be, I think it was over £1,000, and it would be quite a heavy weight of map.
Well, when I interviewed Nick Hallisey from Country Walking magazine, he admitted he'd got his dream job.
Okay.
Are you doing your dream job? Having been a walker yourself, are you now involved in, you pinch yourself every time you go to work because you can't believe you're being paid to do what you do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it would be nice if, you know, my job was walking all the time, but, you know, so a lot of it is, you know, at the desk and everything, but it is amazing to be able to lead and push forward a project that will put loads of rights of way back on the map, and also be able to go out and meet and talk to our volunteers and talk to people like you, and, you know, sort of embrace that wider walking world. And it's, you know, something that I never expected when I went on the Land's End to John O'Groats walk, because, you know, I'd never worked in a charity before, I've never worked in this sector at all, so it was it was unexpected, but a very nice thing to get involved with.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, what is the motivation for Jack to go for a walk?
That's difficult to pin down, I think. I'd be interested to know what other walkers say about that. It's almost compulsive. I don't know. That's why it's sort of difficult to get to the heart of. I think it is something about, I suppose, my sort of real passion is urban walking. That's like really sort of, you know, I'm born and grew up in London. I've always walked in London. And so that's my sort of real passion. And there's something about the exploration, the discovery, yeah, so I just can't sort of stop doing it, in a way, which is,
well, you've set yourself another challenge, haven't you, which is you're going to walk every street in London. But when did you start that one?
I was trying to work this out. I think I started about 10 years ago now. It started off quite piecemeal. It basically, I lived then in Brixton, and I worked in Holborn. I was walking to work 3 or 4 days a week. I got bored of walking along the same road, so I started doing side street, and I thought, oh, I should probably like note down which side streets I'm going up. So it, in a way, the walking every street in London has expanded out from the Kennington Road to sort of slowly fill every bit of London, really.
It's not actually built into your commute any longer, is it? It's, every weekend you're trying to find another bit of London you haven't walked?
Yeah, it's not built into my commute because I've done all the side roads on my current commute. Yeah, it's a bit of a mixture, really. Like, I do pretty regularly go out and do a 20-mile walk in a new bit of London and just explore, but it also involves, you know, you're going to meet some friends at the pub, go there 20 minutes early, walk around the block, cross off some streets, you know, going shopping or whatever, and just go a slightly different way. It's that sort of thing. And it's, I think the thing I noticed is that probably there'll be places where, right near where you live or work, streets you've never been down, because why would you?
Yeah,
you
there's know? No purpose in doing
exactly.
So.
But you never know what's on it. So yeah. That's, you know, that it's that, it's that sort of unexpected.
Well, at the weekend I organised a seasonal slow marathon, yeah, as I called it, around the borough of Greenwich, because I was trying to keep to the borough boundary as close as possible. It did mean that we walked through some fairly odd bits, and people actually enjoyed the variety of bits. But what they did weary of was suburbia. And I have my suspicions that once you've left central London, there's a heck of a lot of suburbia that you'd have to walk through to accomplish what you've set yourself to.
So the definition of London I'm using goes from, it's basically the big A to Z. So it goes from High Barnet to south of Croydon, Romford to Heathrow. But I think people are a bit down on suburbia sometimes. I mean, there is maybe, I can see why people slightly, you know, maybe wouldn't like the spending an afternoon walking 17 identical streets in Ealing or something like that. But I quite like it. And, you know, you sort of, you see people's personalities come out in their houses, and you see sort of weird gardens, or you never know what you're going to see. And
do you stop and chat to people, or do people go step away and keep a wide? there's that strange chap walking every street in London.
You know what? I don't talk to people, and that's probably, I don't know why, but I think it's probably just being a Londoner, maybe. But because you do get that weird thing about, you know, what does every street mean? Well, that literally every street that includes muses and dead ends and cul-de-sacs, and so there's always a slight feeling of apprehension when I walk into a cul-de-sac and I see somebody doing their front garden at the end of it, and they just sort of look at me as I walk down to the end of it and then turn slowly round and walk back out. If someone asked me what I'm doing, I would say, well, maybe I'd tell them, but I probably, if I was, you know, not in the mood for a longer chat, I'd probably just say, oh, maybe I'm looking to rent a flat in the area, so I'm just having a look round.
In a sense, it's kind of mindfulness therapy.
Yeah,
I mean, there's something going on here with Jack, isn't there? Because he's taken 4 months to take a very, very long walk through the British Isles.
Yeah.
Many people really aspire to that, so even myself, so I'm not going to mark that down as madness. But then there is a bit of obsessiveness going on with collecting every street.
Yeah.
What's more, this year, 2020, I understand, you know, you want to make sure you walk at least 2020 miles as well. So there's yet more adding up going on.
Yeah, I think there is some of that going on. Where that comes from, I don't know. Maybe I'm a completionist. Maybe I don't know. I like having, I probably have more spreadsheets for my outside work life than I do for work. So I don't know what that says about me. But
okay, Jack, it's going to be hard for you because I know you've walked many, many places, but including in strange parts of London that none of us will ever walk. But would you like to recommend a couple of places to go for a walk?
Oh, that's a difficult question, though, isn't it? Let me think. I'm going to do one London one and one outside London. I think my London one, being sort of born and bred in South East London, would have to be there. So I'm going to go for the Broccoli Three Peaks, which is a walk on my doorstep, and that takes in, well, the peaks of Blythe Hill, Hilly Fields and One Tree Hill, but also Lady Well Fields, which is an amazing park near me. And actually, it's a really good walk sort of in of itself. It's been created by the community, but the history of the actual places, and what I particularly like, and maybe this is the rambler in me coming out, but One Tree Hill has a history of mass trespass even before Kinder Scout, and that was when a golf club was going to be built there. I think in the 1910s, they kept on putting up fences so they could knock down the woods and create a golf club, and literally every time the locals just stormed, thousands of locals stormed it and ripped down the fences, and now it's a public park, so that sort of speaks to me quite a lot. But yeah, and then outside London, I suppose I'm going to take one that's the most surprising bit that I did in Land's End to John O'Groats, which is along the Solway coast. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's never really spoken about, but it's amazing. Behind you, you've got the Lake District, and then across the water, you've got about, I think it's Argyll, but then you've got this flat area on the Solway coast, and there's just something, I don't know, it's such a surprise to me that it was sort of the sort of beauty of it that's never really spoken about. I suppose maybe because it's so close to the Lake District, and so that sort of draws the punters away. But I'd recommend, if you're going to the Lake District, get out and do a day or two's walking on the Solway. It's nice.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Jack Cornish. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stark of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.